two articles in the Irish Times last month, one by Joe Humphreys and the other by Justine McCarthy, raise some interesting questions. Do you suffer from FOCO, F-O-C-O, the fear of causing offence? And why I have finally had enough of other people's rudeness. While on different topics, they relate to the interactions between people, either their ill-mannered behaviour or indeed public timidity in challenging belligerence and boorishness. In a small way, these articles pinpoint how we are still learning how to deal with each other and how to challenge bad or insensitive behaviours, loud phones in buses, selfish car parking, etc. These are the small hurdles, maybe in an even faster and impersonal life of mobile phones and media. But they can lead to considerable discomfort, even mental upset. And these scenarios are just a microcosm of the confrontations in the political, philosophical, and religious arenas where courage beyond the ordinary can be needed if we are to remain as true to our principles as we can. According to Jonathan Friedland, in his book, The Traitor's Circle, it is estimated that in the 12 years of National Socialism in Germany, about 3 million Germans, or 5% of the population, were in and out of prisons for crimes of dissent. Most of us, says Friedland, think we would have been brave. But the statistics show that almost all of us would have been silent. He then goes on to outline the courage of three Germans who defied the Nazis until they were betrayed. See how in the United States, media, universities, and the technological industries have succumbed to White House bullying. How indeed many Americans have embraced an ugly, domineering, and money-driven philosophy, despite a core of what looks like increasing dissenters. It's worth recalling the famous phrase, "When good men do nothing." In Marcus Aurelius's words, "Often injustices lie in what we aren't doing, not only in what we are doing." As Ryan Holiday and Stephen Hanselman say in the Daily Stoic, which I've just read from now, "History abounds with evidence that humanity is capable of doing evil, not only actively, but passively." They say, that's Holiday and Handelson, say that in some of our most shameful moments, from slavery to the Holocaust, guilt wasn't only limited to the perpetrators, but also to ordinary citizens, who, for a multitude of reasons, decline to oppose bad and even murderous behavior. We could indeed look to our national failure in allowing the continuation for so long of the Magdalen laundries and Letterfrack and our Tain reformatories, among others. We didn't know, we say, but there's knowing and knowing. And the collective unknowing is a stain, perhaps, on our nation. Leaving aside, perhaps, the exquisite writing, acting, and directing the success of Claire Keegan's Small Things Like These and the resulting film indicate how official and religious secrecy and cruelty and society's whatever you say, say nothing mode resonates among today's public, particularly among older people. As one prosperous old woman said to me, "We sent all our laundry there, the Magdalen laundries, as we thought we were helping the girls." The hero in the Keegan novella is, of course, Bill Furlong, a coal merchant who finds an undernourished and freezing girl in the cellar of the convent. He then confronts the convent nuns and also later has to face the effect his championing of the girl might have on his own family's expectations. And there's a long list of people in our modern history who have challenged church or political establishments, views which incidentally were shared by the majority of the population. Of course, stances on what is right and wrong do change. Indeed, there is a long philosophical title in a recent book by Omar El Akkad, which highlights, and this is the title, "One day when it's safe, when there is no personal downside to calling a thing what it is, when it's too late to hold anybody accountable, everyone will have been against this." Which is maybe why so many public inquiries are held many years after the events being investigated. The big challenge, and perhaps one some of us may feel strongly about, is the cancelling derision and nastiness encountered by writers, politicians, and others in the public eye who put forward views which run contrary to what is termed progressive. Dermot Ferriter, the UCD Modern Irish History professor, recounts in the Irish Times in September, how the LNH recently rescinded its decision to award the author John Boyne the prestigious Ulysses Medal, quotes, "because of what many regard as his offensive views on transgender issues, which are trenchantly and provocatively expressed." The irony was, the medal was to be given to a writer who was said, quotes, "to be one of Ireland's most celebrated and courageous literary voices, who has consistently tackled the themes that matter, identity, morality, power, shame, and the search for truth, with searing honesty and compassion." This is the society, as Ferriter recalls, where James Joyce had the courage to challenge the UCD president, Father William Delaney, who had said that Joyce's paper, Drama and Life, was not suitable to be given to the society. Joyce, the ultimate dissenter, confronted Delaney, who then decided not to press his objections to the paper being read. And as with Joyce, there are many other Irish examples of moral and responsible dissent in either the religious, political, or secular arenas. First, just for context, we might look at biblical dissent. In an intriguing chapter titled Audacity, in his book The Story of Virtue, Joe Humphreys highlights the incidents in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity where even God the Lord has faced dissent from his subjects. Abraham challenges the Lord by asking him whether he is really going to destroy the innocent with the guilty in Sodom and Gomorrah. If there are 50 innocent people in the city, will you destroy it? He asked the Lord. And God says he will spare the whole city if there are 50 innocent people. But Abraham persists, asking him if there are 45 people, etc., etc. The message here, according to Humphreys, is that audacity or dissent and faith need not be in conflict. Abraham showed that the virtue that Jews called chutzpah is not the enemy of faith, but a supporting friend. It's not a license to mock sacred belief, but a healthy ability to challenge it. In the major religion, says Humphreys, there's a trade-off between virtues, and certain virtues should yield to others depending on the situation. So reasoning not only acts as a check on unquestioning devotion, but it helps to consolidate faith on the basis that beliefs are contested. But compared to Judaism, other faiths except Hinduism have a strange relationship with audacity or dissent. For traditional Muslims, it is one of the three crimes for which capital punishment is justified. However, while Muslims believe the Quran to be the literal word of God, tradition decreed for hundreds of years that senior Muslims were entitled to interpret the holy book. There was then a backlash against this, but now there are reformist Muslims who have argued that each adherent should apply the disciplined use of independent reasoning to best appreciate the meaning of his or her faith. And for Hindus, skepticism can be a positive disposition, paving the way for philosophic thought. Ownership of faith for them requires a testing of belief, challenging and adapting to it. So, where does this leave Christians? While Pope John Paul II said that faith and independent reasoning were both to be embraced, as they offer each other a purifying critique, Humphreys believes this has created a Catholic Church somewhat skeptical of the benefits of independent thought. Although various popes down the centuries have rubbished papal infallibility, including John the 22nd, who described it as the father of all lies. And without independent thought, there would have been no Reformation, which in turn led to the spawning of many different versions of Protestantism. And throughout the decades, there have been many Catholics and other Christians who dissented courageously in the secular and religious world. Let's just quickly highlight a few, particularly people who took on the church and state to campaign against the common practice of teachers beating children. Perhaps the most extraordinary campaigners were doctors Mary and Paddy Randalls, who in the early 60s in Navan protested against the beatings meted out by De La Salle brothers and the recruitment practices of religious orders, taking children as young as 12 from their families. Paddy went to the News of the World, which ran a series called Children on the Lash. But the papers were taken off the shop shelves before massgoers had a chance to read them. One particular incident is shocking. A boy called Norman broke his arm falling from a tree, and his mother wanted Dr. Paddy to write a note asking the teacher to beat him on his good arm rather than on the injured one. Norman started writing with his left hand, and this enraged the teacher so much that he attacked him with a rubber hose. Dr. Paddy went to the headmaster to complain that one of his teachers was beating the boy on his broken arm with a rubber hose. And the headmaster then threw a piece of leather on the table and said, "This is what I use." It had metal inserts. Paddy, the ultimate dissenter, wrote letters to the newspapers, which were generally ignored. His tires were slashed, practice windows smashed, half his patients left him, and the delivery van with the newspapers was hijacked and the papers thrown into the River Boyne. As recalled in the film Pray for Our Sinners, when Mary came to Navan, women were having 12 and 14 babies. Some women came to say they had to use contraceptives, and they wanted a letter to bring to confession on Saturday to show to the priest. Mary told them they'd be better asking the bus driver or anyone else before they'd go to a priest. And linking in with the Randalls was Cork man Dr. Cyril Daly, who many of us may remember, who was a convinced Catholic, took on church and state, and to whom Irish children, as well as for the Randalls, owe a huge debt for his campaigning against teacher violence. Daly, who heard from one of his sons about a boy being beaten in St. Paul's in Raheny, took his son out and educated him at home until he got him into Sandford Park School. He found it very hard to reconcile such beatings with the religious calling of priests, nuns, and lay brothers. The campaign, which attracted vociferous attacks from the INTO, rumbled on for 7 years, and in 1968, Daly joined with Frank Crummy, a multi-careered campaigner on social issues, on The Late Late Show. Both men were scorned by fellow panelists and shouted down by hecklers. And it's not clear whether it was on The Late Late Show or on another show on corporate punishment that when Crummy said, "As I sit here tonight, an Irish Christian brother is abusing a child," someone from the audience ran up and threw a punch at him. It is to those brave, wonderful dissidents that we owe gratitude for campaigning, often at great cost, on a wide number of issues to the betterment of Irish society. From family planning to corporate punishment to censorship and the Irish language freedom movement. And it would be wrong not to mention the persistent crusading by the late Tom Wolfe, who for many decades fought to have the GAA ban on foreign games, let's rugby, hockey, etc., removed after facing much vilification. And Tom Flannery, the redemptorist priest, who at great cost publicly questioned the Catholic Church's doctrine on women priests, contraception, and homosexuality. All of the above, and Unitarians can be proud of this, are in the tradition of Peter Gonoesius, 1525 to 1573, who first spoke out about the doctrine of the Trinity. His agitation sparked a 9-year debate culminating in the Polish Brethren, which left Poland and dispersed to Transylvania and Holland before their Unitarian ideas spread to this part of the world and the United States. The Irish people mentioned above are in that proud tradition. And as Unitarians, maybe we have to ask ourselves whether we should be more willing individually to embrace similar dissenting attitudes. even about less momentous issues, and there are many of them. Whether we should be more probing, resistant to some commonly accepted practices. My own personal view: excessively low taxes on inheritance, monster cars, extreme public noise, undue self-censorship. Do we fail to make our voices heard on, for example, whether we are a church or a movement, as is described sometimes over in Britain? Whether we should actively seek new members, are indeed the structures of our services. I think the dissenting tradition should be a continuous process, and we should be moving further and further away from Romans 13, which says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God." We should be dissenters. I think a much nicer word than Protestants. And if needs must be, even practicing, as in the title of Fergus Whelan's book, Descent into Treason, I'm exaggerating a bit, but perhaps we should be conscious of dissenting more often. This could be our inspiration and our aspiration as this church moves in the future decades. Thank you very much.